Have you ever seen someone living an amazing life and thought to yourself, how'd they get so lucky? If you are not currently living a life that's on your terms, a life by your design, then this podcast series is for you. This is the More Confidence with Luna Guy podcast. And in this special season, I'm going to be interviewing people who are living a life by design, living a life on their terms. And I'm going to find out once and for all if it is just luck or there's something more going on. Let's dive in.
Katrina, in 2010, you attended your first AA meeting. And for you, that was a life-changing, transformational experience. What led you to that moment where you walked into that meeting?
Desperation that I've had enough. And really, what led me into that meeting was somebody outside of myself who cared enough to take me to that meeting. I didn't know that's where we were going. She told me we were going to get a burger to eat because I've had a drinking problem. And I was arguing with my husband, and my mother-in-law intervened and came in and said, "Let's go get a burger." And I reluctantly went, and she ended up bringing me into a women's AA meeting. She knew where to go from different people, and I didn't want to go in. A lady came out and talked to me, and I don't even remember what she said because I was pretty wasted. But something she said took me in there, and it was that, I think it was that little slice of hope, like, okay, there's a little slice of hope. And I knew deep within I didn't want to be doing what I was doing, but I didn't know what else to do. And so there was that little bit of hope and the little bit of willingness that was like, okay, let's check this out. Let's just see what's going to come of it.
So tell me, it's 2010, you're drinking is, you're in a position where you don't really want to be in, but it's the only way that you know. You rock up at this AA meeting and you are, you're intoxicated at the time. Is that right?
Yes, very intoxicated. Yes.
Very, very intoxicated. Do they let you in the room when that happens? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, they do. They don't turn anyone away. And I even shared in that meeting, apparently, and a lot of people of my friends later were like, "That was one of the most profound shares that I've ever heard." But
Wow.
they will let you in, and you will be guided depending on where you're at. Like, not a lot of people come in drunk, that I experienced, at least not to the degree that I was. But we lovingly guide you. They lovingly guide you, like, "Hey, we need you to quiet down." And if you share, they'll let you share until they're like, "Okay, that's enough."
Plenty, plenty now.
Yes,
Now you're being
yes.
destructive or whatever it happens to be.
Yes, exactly.
So that was a turning point in your life.
It was a huge turning point in my life. I didn't stop drinking right away, but I kept going back to meetings because I heard something there, obviously. That stuck with me. And the second part was I had a group of women and one woman specifically come up to me and be like, "I want to help you." And I hadn't really had that before. I had family around, but like family, when they try to help you, if you're in a situation like that, like, what do they know? They just see my flaws. But this stranger would come up to me and say, "I want to help you," and extended a hand. And I said, "Okay." And I actually called her over the next, I don't know how long it was. I think it was approximately a month or so between that meeting and between that meeting and the time that I went in and got evaluated to go to an inpatient treatment center, which I ended up doing for 28 days. And so I doing that, I was a mom too of twins at the time. They were 18 months old, had a family, but they extended a hand to me, and I don't know, there was just like, okay, I know that I've tried all the things, sort of, to the best of my ability. This is something I hadn't tried yet.
So 18-month-old twins at that point in time. Can you give us a bit of an idea of like what was your drinking like up until that point?
So I was a very good girl most of my childhood. I followed all of the rules, and drinking wasn't my first drug of choice. Actually, marijuana was, and I didn't even start doing that till I was like 19. And I drank when I was young, before I turned 21, which is our legal drinking age. And but I preferred getting high over getting drunk. But once I turned 21, like, it was game on. And I thought, this is what we do. We're 21. We party. We go out on the weekends. But I didn't understand the depth of which I already had the genetics. I already had the predisposition of drinking. I have alcoholism in my family. And, you know, for a while it was just on the weekends. And then it became every day. And it became to the point where I couldn't not drink. I would drive around drunk. I would, like, tell my husband I was going to the store and, like, leave and not come back for several hours because I went to the local bar. I would wake up and, like, be shaking within my body because I needed to drink alcohol. I would wake up and get my kids ready and feed them and then, like, put them in their room with a baby gate up so I could go drink, like, pass out on the floor next to them because I was so hungover from the day before. Thankfully, I had people around and angels around that were guarding them and watching them. But I couldn't not drink. And I was always a blackout drinker. I was always a go big or go home girl. And part of that, I think, is having to prove, like, I was worth something, that I could keep up with the people, because I never felt like I fit in. And my group of friends before I'd met my husband and got married were all guys. Like, I hung out with the guys. And so I hung out and I kept up with the guys. But it was always a go big or go home, blackout drinking, don't remember a lot of things that happened. And a lot of crazy crap did happen during that time. But I would promise myself almost daily, like, I'm not going to drink today. Okay. Or I'm only going to have one. Or, like, my husband and I would go out to dinner and I was like, okay, I'm only having one. And then it would be like, oh, but how about, let's do another one. Like, I would always come up, oh, it's going to be more fun if we hang out a little bit more. Here, let's order another drink and that kind of thing. And just, it really spiraled pretty quickly for me, which is typical for women.
It's typical for women, is it?
Yeah, it's typical for women for the disease of alcoholism to progress much faster than men. And something within us, there's genetics, DNA, and all the things behind the scenes. It's typical that we go much faster, like, on that journey if we're going to than guys do.
I'm curious what you said before about self-worth, that, you know, a big part of the reason why you drank in the first place was that kind of fitting in, that self-worth, that feeling like you were enough, or that you, you know, were the same as everyone else, your guy friends, that kind of vibe. How has that played out later on in your life? Like, obviously alcoholism is something, and we'll get to it, that isn't, you know, plaguing your life anymore. How have you got to a point where your self-worth has, obviously the question that I want to ask is, how did you develop enough self-worth to stop drinking?
Well, for me, it going to inpatient treatment, I had to get away from my situation.
Yeah.
And because I was so at what they call the rock bottom at that point in time in my life, I was so desperate. I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired that I was done. And for me, the gift of being able to get away from my situation, get around people who could actually help me, and to understand, like, this wasn't because I was broken. This wasn't my fault. There was nothing wrong with me necessarily, that there was hope, that there was a possibility of living a different way, is what started to build that self-worth within me. And when I was in treatment, there was a point in time where I got upset at my counselor. We were in a small group. I got upset and I left the room and I ran out. There was this little creek down by the main building. And I prayed. And I didn't go to church. I'm not religious. I didn't grow, but I always believed in God, that there was always a God of some sort. And I just, like, God, help me. Please help me. I don't know what to do. And I'm looking up at the sky and I'm listening to the water. And I look down and there's this little heart-shaped rock. And I was like, it's like that, they call it a burning bush moment. Like, there's God reminding me that I'm loved, that I'm taken care of. Wow. And for me, the craving, like, left immediately. I no longer craved alcohol. I was on fire for life because I wanted something different so much. I was caught up in that excitement, in that thrill of, like, there's relief here. There's something more for me here. And so I immediately jumped into working the program of the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they take you through the program. That's where I was first introduced to like personal development, personal growth kind of work. And yeah. I started to feel better just bit by bit.
You've mentioned hope several times.
Yeah.
That first meeting that you got sat, you know, convinced to go into from having a burger. Well, actually you're doing that. What a godsend that was for you, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually getting into inpatient treatment. You've mentioned hope several times throughout that. And I want to be really clear here. Was it that the circumstances outside of you pushed you into feeling that hope, or pushed you, you know, was it the rock that you saw that really created the change? What was it for you that really made you go, I can see a different path? It could be true for me.
Yeah, I think that it was really, truly a combination, a divine intervention from outside sources and something within my own spirit that was searching for something. And if I could just get that little bit of indication, direction, because I've always been a person who's looked outside of myself for things. And, but that it was a combination of the outside influence. Like even still, I'm like, God, just show me a sign. Right. Instead of like knowing within, like I do now, that I have everything that I need. But it was both. There was just something in my spirit that still resided there. That's been there from that small child who used to like sing and dance and talk to God and grandpa and grandma who had passed away. Like, I think it was just a combination of both.
Yeah. Okay. And I love that you've said that. What do you think that part of you, like, how did you know it was ready to create change? That you were ready to create change?
For me, I didn't see another way out. I didn't see any other option. My spirit was tired. My body was breaking down. I was on the verge of probably losing a lot of everything, my family, my kids, my marriage. And I figured it was as if I was dead, but I was still walking around. Like there was a death within me. Or at least I was close to it, like spiritually dead inside. And, you know, when you get to that place where that hopelessness and you're not quite ready to like take it all away, you know, meaning, you know, suicide, take yourself out, whatever that is. Yeah. Like there's three options. Either I choose a different path, and I try this thing out with this getting sober and walking this path, I go to jail, because there's guaranteed with the way that I was behaving and acting, I would have ended up in jail, or I die, or like
end it. Yeah.
Death. Yeah, yeah. End it.
That those moments, I think that, you know, so many of the listeners here can relate, and maybe not into the extremities of the situation that you're in, but to so many people, they're staring down a barrel of feeling spiritually dead.
Yeah.
Or feeling just like that kind of low-level hopelessness of quiet desperation. Mm-hmm. In their everyday life, they're thinking to themselves, what is all of this about? What am I doing this for? And maybe for them it's they're overeating. Maybe it's overworking. Maybe they're sick and tired of being the persona of who they think that they should be.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are going to relate to that story. You have also said to me that you're the only person in your family who's on this path, who's gone down sobriety. You know, you mentioned before that alcoholism is in your family. What does it take for you to step outside of the family unit, particularly when you want to belong, when you want to feel like you're enough and fit in? What does it take for you to step outside of the family unit and be the only one who's on this path?
Yeah. A lot of work, especially as a person who also has that codependent, always felt like she didn't quite fit into the family. And it's really about finding people to be with and work with who are living the kind of life, the kind of dynamic that you want. and surrounding myself with those people. For at that time, it was the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, finding those people who could show me a different way of life, because I only knew, we only know what we know, which is usually what we grow up in and what we're surrounded with. So I had to surround myself with new people. And a lot of it is about practicing, like literally practicing, building the muscle of, okay, I can do this. I can step outside. I don't have to participate, putting up the boundaries that are needed. Again, practicing with the boundaries and finding love and compassion for myself and for them, being able to accept who they are and what their lifestyle is, and coming to accept that I don't have to participate. I can love them, and I can still show up when I want to show up, but I don't have to be so enmeshed and involved in it. But it's different for so many people, but it's really the practicing and deciding, where do I want these people? How do I want to be in this family? How do I want to participate? Or maybe I just need to not participate for a while. Maybe I need to back off for a while. And it takes you through a grueling process of learning how to truly love yourself and trust yourself, and letting the people who are doing the kind of work and living the kind of life you want to come in and love you and support you, and asking them for help and receiving their help, and just kind of like walking your way through until it's no longer that grueling process for you.
Yeah. Yeah. What I'm really hearing is that you have to go into the dark night of the soul. You know, you have to be willing to go and face the demons that are inside.
Yeah.
And love them and find a way to love them. And that the way that you've done that, Katrina, is to be able to have a new family, for want of a better term. You know, you relied upon a set of people who were living a kind of life that you wanted to.
Yeah.
Rather than continuing to stay with the family that you had. And it doesn't mean that you've deleted them from your life, but you've gone, the way that they live isn't the way that I want to live. Yeah. So I need to find other people to be around.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. You were given the gift of, given the gift of AA through that process. Yeah. Do you still, is that a big part of your life, like continues to be?
It was up until, I mean, truthfully, up until probably 2016. And then it still was a little bit, but by 2021, I don't go to AA meetings anymore. I'm not involved. I'm in contact with still some of my friends from there, but I don't rely upon that anymore. I stay in work in other ways.
Yeah, because you're a spiritual and personal transformational coach. You have your own podcast, Just As We Are, and you're also an author. You really help women step into their enoughness. And I can tell that, to me, when I see really what I know is going to make a really great coach, apart from the fact that there's training and that stuff, if you've walked the road that you are leading people down, it makes you a really great guide. I know that you help people to live, you know, that you lead from your heart and you live a life that you love. You teach people how to do that because you've been in the space for over 12 years. You're a certified coach and it's been a journey for you. How are you living life on your terms now? If we fast forward, you know, it's 14 years since that fateful day of walking to that women's AA meeting. What does life look like for Katrina now?
Yeah. It's pretty cool now. And it's beautiful now. Like it is, this is one of the things like I have a hard time like really relaying to people, just because, you know, life is so much better than I ever thought it would be. If you looked at Katrina, like even 5 years ago, she had her vision and created that life. My life is not what that vision is. There's speckles of it. There's glitter, like parts of it, but it's even better now than what I ever could have imagined. And that is something I can't give somebody, but I can, until you experience it for yourself. But now I mean, I've broken down so many generational things that have been passed down with codependency, with alcoholism, with, you know, just those inner family relational things. And I get to be an example, a different example for my three children who don't experience the kind of life and environment that I grew up in. I am so much more present, and my kids come to me and they share things with me that I know that I never felt comfortable or safe to do with my own parents. And, you know, building this beautiful life by my own design, a person who never had a career, never was quite sure, like, she had dreams of what she wanted to do when she was little, but those got lost among all of the chaos of life. And finding out, like, I am not a 9-to-5 corporate job. Like, there's a part of me who can step into that, but my passion is, you know, getting to meet with people and support them in living their own life in the way that they feel that they want to, like leading from that heart, opening up from that heart, you know, living here in the Pacific Northwest of Washington State and camping and hiking and connecting with Mother Nature and going out with girlfriends and, you know, just simple life in a way that I never would have imagined before, but it's so intentional. And it's, you know, checking in with myself, learning to trust myself, learning to trust my heart. What do I want to do today? Today I'm going to dance to something. Today I'm going to just read a book. Today I'm going to show up and record a podcast. Like, really getting to learn to live the way and check in with myself every day and knowing that it might change tomorrow. Tomorrow I might decide, yeah, I want to go like work at this job, or I want to go do this. Like, but I get to decide instead of somebody else deciding for me.
Yeah. How do you couple that with, you know, what I've seen in terms of business, in terms of being, you know, self-directed? It requires, in my experience, a considerable amount of discipline.
Yeah.
To be able to, you know, like, what you've described there is fabulous around going, cool, you know, I'm going to be in a podcast today, or I'm going to go for a hike, or I'm going to hang out with girlfriends. How do you couple that with, like, getting the work done that's required, the very practical work of you know, making money in business?
Yeah. It is not one of my stronger suits. I will tell you that. Discipline and I have a very fun relationship. Yeah. There are some things like I am willing to show up for. Like, I am a person who will show up and has showed up for other people very easily and, you know, supporting them and helping them and growing their business. And even for, you know, like if it's all about you. So the relationship has shifted over the last year or two. Is like, how can I give as much love and attention to myself consistently with devotion and that discipline as I do other people? And there are days where I'm like, okay, this is a work day. Like, these couple of hours are a work day. And then I'm going to go and do something fun. And then I'm going to come back to it and setting deadlines for myself, setting things on the calendar. Like, I said, I was going to do this. And again, it's all about the practice. And, you know, running a business is not easy if you're not self-driven, if you don't have that discipline. And not all of us have that discipline, but understanding that it's okay if you don't, because it's a muscle we build. It's a muscle we build. So making small promises to myself or commitments to myself, and the smaller, starting out small, I had to start out small, is making those commitments, showing up, celebrating to reinforce, like, this is a good thing, celebrating. And then I raise the bar, and then I do it all over again. And then I raise the bar even more. And then when I fall off, because that's a natural part of being a human being. Okay, here's some compassion and some grace for myself. Let's do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, because you're speaking before about how, you know, you would promise yourself that you're only going to have one drink, or you promise yourself, I'm not going to drink today, and then you broke those promises. And I'm seeing this correlation between, you know, that low self-worth that you had at the time. How has it changed now for you? Like, what has helped you to keep your promises?
It's
not always consistent.
Yeah, it's not always consistent. It is, one, having somebody outside of myself to help me and support me in, like, a coach or a guide, like somebody to help hold me accountable, but they do it in a way that is not like, okay, you said you were going to do this, but a loving, supportive way. Mm-hmm. And getting really deeply into understanding what it is I actually want and desire for my own life.
Yeah.
Because if I am operating from that place of where this feels like a commitment based upon what somebody else is telling me to do or thinks I should do, or I'm trying to copy a dream of theirs, I'm not going to be as attached to it. And that's been a hard lesson to learn. But what do I want to do? And really lately, like zooming out, because it's so easy to get zoomed in when we do this work. We're zooming in. We're getting real close. Like, this is the goal. This is the dream. This is what, like, zooming out, like looking further out than today or next week. What kind of life do I want to have when I'm 60 years old?
Yeah.
What's that life look like?
Yeah.
And how fun can it get? Like, cause for me, it needs to be fun. All right. I don't like it. If it's fun, if it's hard, even though, you know, I work through that everything needs to be hard kind of way. But if it's, I want it to be fun. I want it to be joyful and peaceful. Zooming out, who is that 6-year-old woman? What is she doing with her life? And then kind of like backtracking.
I think there's something so incredibly powerful around that, around the zooming out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're saying before that the vision board that you had 5 years ago, there's sprinkles of it now. I think that there's that, when we hold on so tightly to how we think it's meant to be, mm-hmm. we can get, I think, blindsided, or we don't allow ourselves to have the freedom of what might come. At the same time, there needs to be that equal balance of, well, I do want to think about the long term.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I don't love goals. I don't love setting goals. That they're not something that generally, like, short term motivates me particularly well. But what inspires me is who I'm becoming. Who do I want to be in the long term? And I think that your 60-year-old self, 70, 80, 90-year-old self, what kind of life do you want to look back on?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me, Katrina, what's something in life that's guaranteed to make you sob? Like, just guaranteed to just bring on the waterworks for better or for worse, for, you know, for laughter or for joy or for sadness?
Oh, my goodness. That's an interesting question, and I love it. Like, what is guaranteed to make me sob is, like seeing one of my kids' like goals of theirs that they've worked so hard for not come through. Like, watching them work so hard for something and Mama Bear comes out and my heart just breaks for them. And like, because I know I just want the very best for them.
Yeah.
And so that's one of those things, like, if we were to look at it, like, what just makes my heart break? And then there's definitely, like, the other thing coming in quickly to share is, like, there's certain songs that just move me, that remind me of my divinity and my beauty and to surrender, and it doesn't have to be so. There's some of those songs that are just like, okay, that's right. It always brings a tear to my eye.
Do you know any off the top of your head? Because I know that sometimes I might be asked that question. I'm like, no, but I know when I hear it. Do you know any off the top of your head?
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm going to say their name right, but it's called In Dreams by Jay Jagdish, something like that. But it's a beautiful song. It's J-A-I is their first little part, but In Dreams. And it's like, it just brings you in. I was actually listening to it earlier and I was like, oh, this is my heart tugger.
Oh, I love that. I've got one by it's an Australian artist called Rashani. And she's got a song called I Am Freedom.
Ooh.
And it is just, I mean, her voice is incredible. The way that she articulates, she says, if I'm not my gender, my race, my skin color, then what am I? And she says, well, I must be freedom. And it just speaks to that deeper part of us. You talked about hope before, and you've spoken quite extensively in our kind of off-air conversations around surrender.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Letting go every day, every moment, turning it over to God, source, universe, spirit, whatever it is that you pray or speak to. But it's letting go of that expectation of how it's going to look and allowing universe, God, to do its magic. Like, I don't need to be in control. If I'm in control, I am not surrendered to what is. So it's that space of allowing what is. And it's again, it's another thing. We have to practice it every day, sometimes moment by moment. Like, okay, I'm giving this over and giving this over and giving this over, like, as many times as I can. And it really is, once I lay it down at that altar of love to God, like, I'm giving it over and I'm like, hands off and open.
How do you do that from a very practical point of view for listeners at home? Like, that you're there and you're maybe feeling like, well, there's a certain outcome that I want, you know, and you spoke about children, you know, your children not getting their goals and you wanted to control that, you know, like wanting them to be able to get that. From a very practical point of view, you're there, you're wanting a certain outcome to happen. How do you then surrender? Like, what is the process of that? What is the practice?
Yeah, it starts by just talking or praying. Like, talking and praying are one and the same to me. And offering, sometimes I write it down. Sometimes I'm like, I'm offering this over and I'll burn it in the fire. So that way I know that it goes up and I give it to God. Sometimes it is, okay, I'm letting this go and I shake it out of my body because I can feel when it's held in my body. So it's different. It depends on what it depends on like where I'm at, what I need, how strongly I'm holding on to it. But that gets to look different for everybody. But like, I love burning. I love burning and turning it over that way. And I love the dancing or the shaking and just like, okay, just keep doing it until you start to feel that surrender. Cause that's, it's layers.
Yeah. And would you, you know, is it something that we would expect to feel immediately? Like, you know, if I'm there and I've shaken it out and I'm feeling myself, you know, like I'm feeling like I was feeling control and then I'm like shaking it out. I'm verbally surrendering it to God. I'm writing it down. I'm burning it. Will we always feel that relief that comes from that?
No, I don't think we will.
Yeah.
We won't until we're like, we're experts at it. And I don't know if you ever become an expert at it as a human form being. You don't always, and you just don't. And I think that a lot of people expect that they're supposed to feel a sense of freedom. No, it's in the act of that process that we learn to let go. And eventually, sometimes you will feel that sense of release and sometimes you won't.
Because ultimately we're not in control of it anyway.
No.
We're releasing a false sense of certainty, really. That's what it is. We're thinking that we are under control. We think that we can really choose the outcomes. But ultimately we can't. Even if we go back to you going into sobriety, you going on that, you know, burger run with your mother-in-law at the time, you know, you were expecting burgers, but what you got was AA, right? And we can only control our actions, you know, our thoughts, our beliefs. What are we putting intention into is all that we actually have control over. So surrendering seems like, to me, often the most sensible thing to do, but also the most challenging.
It is the most challenging, but like you said, the most sensible thing to do. And it's so funny because to me, as you're saying that, because like, we really don't get a say anyway. I mean, we do by how we show up, but we really don't have a say. Like, it's going to happen or it's not going to happen, whatever it is. If it's a part of the plan that you came here to be a part of, it's going to happen. If it's not, okay, you know, but we get ourselves so caught up and so frustrated and overwhelmed and twisted up when it's not necessary. We're here to experience and enjoy our life.
Yeah. What surprised you most in your journey of life so far, when you look back, and it could be at any point in your life, but what has come as the biggest surprise in your life that you weren't expecting?
Dang, that's a really great question. You know, I don't know if I'd call it a surprise, but just how funny life is. And that you know, when you're going through, depending on where you start on your journey, when you're going through it, like I started in the personal development world and went through personal development programs. And then I found myself going into spirituality and working through spiritual stuff. And my mind was like, oh, it's this or that. Like, no, there's a beautiful intersection of spirituality and personal development that works together. And it's not a surprise, but it's just like the, oh, you mean like it gets to be both? Yeah. And it's always funny when I am reminded, like, it gets to be both. Like, there's not one way or the other. And I guess actually what's coming as you, like, I think I am my own surprise. Where my life has led me and ended up, has surprised me. I did not expect my journey to go the way that it has. And that's probably the biggest surprise.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, they're like, oh, kind of like, oh, I made it. Well, look at me go. Like, you know.
Yeah.
You're 21, drinking heavily, you know, and in 2010, you're going on a downward spiral, hitting rock bottom, and then you kind of go, well, look at me now.
Yeah.
You know, who would have thought?
Yeah.
How do you find that dance between, you know, you live an intentional life, you live a deliberate life, a life that is by your choosing, right? And yet we were just talking about surrender. Where do you see those two, when we talk about both in terms of personal development or spiritual development, how do you see those two worlds between choosing, intention, deliberateness, and surrendering to God, the universe?
Yeah, intention is more about what is the experience that I want to have. It's not attached to the thing I do, but what is the experience I want to have, and the value that I like, joy, love, happiness. Because I always relate intention to be like the thing I intended to do this thing. And it is a little bit, but like the intention is more about the experience that I want to have, and the spirituality, the surrender is, but it's this or something better. Like, it's this or something better. That's where the attachment goes. And, you know, you just knowing that God, universe wants what the best for you, and finding, building the faith and trust in that God really wants the best for us.
Irrelevant of whether or not we can see what that is at the time, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What, you know, you've in the spiritual world, you're in the personal development world, what trend or behavior or mindset do you see in the current society that you think is, like, it's popular, but is really damaging?
Positive thinking is one that gets me every time. And also on the other side of that is the whole, like, oh, just surrender and it'll all work out. Yeah. No. It's positive thinking keeps us in the mind. Our subconscious is not in our mind. It is our entire body. It is a combination. That's why a lot of people who are in that positive mindset only realm, and we see it shifting a little bit, they don't get what they want. They don't live the life that they might have success, but they don't actually live a life that they love. Like,
yeah,
success is not the dollar signs in your bank account. And for some it is, that's great. And then the like, oh, surrender, you know, just give it all, pray, like, we non-action kind of thing. Like, we just have to, no, we still have to show up, and we get to live with that intention, and we get to live with that discipline and that commitment and devotion, one foot in front of the other. It's the beautiful magic of both of them coming together.
Look, I can't agree with you more in terms of, you know, seeing that almost like the toxic positivity in terms of good vibes only.
Yeah.
And I often see in the spiritual world around, like, no, I'm just handing it all over, right? I'm handing it all over, and I'm just going to sit down and do nothing.
Yeah.
And you know, I see this as co-creation. We're in a co-creation. What I believe for me is handing over, we're handing over the outcomes. We're handing over the stress and the worry about how or what, you know, how we're going to get there or what there is.
Yeah.
That's what we're handing over. We still need to show up. You know, I can sit there and go, oh, I'd really like to, you know, be in shape. Cool. Well, you can sit there every single day and just surrender it to God that you're going to be in shape and not go to the gym. And guess what?
Yeah.
Your body's going to remain the way that it is. So there needs to be that co-creation of, cool, well, I can't decide what in shape my body's going to look like at the end of this or, you know, in the process of it, but I can decide to show up every single time and let go of the outcomes.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And I just had the visual of, like, the people who do, like, oh, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to frolic in the woods or whatever, which is fabulous. Yeah. I love to do that. Yet I gotta I gotta show up in and put in the work as well. I gotta do the work. I gotta do the reps.
Yes, you gotta do the reps. It cannot. You don't get to live a life on your terms without taking some responsibility.
Yeah.
What's that been like for you? The level of responsibility that you have to take, because when you're, you know, when you're drinking or when you're running away from yourself, you but also people at large, when we're running away from ourselves, we're not taking the responsibility. What has responsibility meant to you in your life?
Yeah, I learned to take radical responsibility early on in my recovery. Radical honesty and responsibility for oneself was really pivotal and two core principles of the work. And it's understanding that taking that radical responsibility is like, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. Yeah, we get to come together in relationships and things like that, but I am in charge of what I feel, think, how I respond. That is mine. Yeah. And like, there's nobody else that gets to come in and determine what that looks like unless I want to hand that power over to them, which some of us do, but it's mine. And it was a relationship I had to build with myself. And there's still areas where we, you know, we're always like working to build, especially for growing and stepping in, but it's a relationship I've had to build with myself. And if you're new to it or you're in it, like, it can be really gut wrenching and gut punching of that radical responsibility, knowing that every single choice I've made in my life has brought me where I am to where I am today. And I get to choose how I view that. And at one point it was like, take out the shame bat, hit yourself over the head a few times. But now it's like grace and compassion and love for the person who did what they knew how to do in that time, you know? And like, what's mine is mine is mine, and what's theirs is theirs.
Yeah. And being able to take that to look at ourselves, really look at ourselves and go, this is mine.
Yeah.
And yes, our parents, our childhood, our society, our situation, the government, the political situation, the financial situation, whatever it is, there are plenty of outside circumstances that are influencing or have influenced who we are and the choices that we make. Yeah. Yet ultimately, there is only one person. There is one person who's making that decision.
Yeah.
You'd easily go, well, you know, of course I'm going to be an alcoholic because my whole family is, because, you know, it runs in the family because all of my friends are doing it. I was 21. Everybody's drinking. It's socially normal. Of course I'm going to be.
Yeah.
You know, what did you expect?
Yeah.
Or you can be like, well, I get to decide that. Irrelevant of the circumstances, I get to be the one that's in charge.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. The story I used to tell my friends growing up was like, if you live the life I live, because my dad left our family when I was 14 years old, whole thing. And that was my story. That was my reason for being the way I was. And it was like, that is true. That is true. But my responsibility now is that I'm holding on to that story and using it as my reason for being a shitty person. Like, that just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And I think that really moving people don't often think that they have a victim mindset, but the victim mindset is not taking responsibility.
Yeah.
The victim mindset is sitting there going, well, it's because of all of that, why I don't have what I have.
Yeah. It's not to diminish what your experience or what happened. Yes, that happened. Yes, that is true. But what do you want to do about it now?
I often say that that when you turned 18, it was certainly in Australia, 18, 21, when you became an adult, the custody was handed over to you.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. your parents have custody over you, full-time custody of you. And then now that you're an adult, it's you now. You are the custodian of your life. You are the one that's now the adult. And, yeah, you have to deal with the consequences of whatever environment you were raised in. But now it's you.
Yeah.
So you can keep bitching and moaning about what your parents did to you and that your dad left at 14 or whatever, and you can. But yeah. what result is that going to get me? Where's it going to lead me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Katrina, it's been wonderful having you here. Tell me about your podcast. Tell me about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So my podcast is the Just As We Are podcast. Similar setup to you. Yours is just bringing people on who have a story to share about the overcoming, the going through, real life, authentic conversations, inspiring, hopeful, motivational. There's so much beauty in our stories. And if somebody can look and hear somebody be like, oh, they did that, I can do this then too. I love that so much. And working with women one-on-one in coaching and I'm working on all of the things, bringing in different workshops. I do cacao ceremonies and breath work. So a lot of good healing and also that moving you forward, stepping into that bold, audacious life that you want to live.
Oh, I love it. Where can we find you?
Yeah, I mostly hang out over on Instagram at Katrina A. Lely, or you can head on to my website and get on my newsletter at katrinalely.co.
Yeah, fabulous. I will put those, all the links and all the bits and pieces to the podcast, to the Instagram, and to the website in the show notes. So for those of you who are curious about hanging out with Katrina, please go do so. Do the thing. Katrina, one last question for you. Five final words of wisdom.
Yeah. It's six. Okay.
Six will do.
Okay. You have everything that you need.
Ah. Yeah, we could even drop the that, couldn't we? You have everything you need.
Yep.
You do. Have everything you need. Yeah. Ah, what a beautiful blessing. Thank you so much for being here with me, Katrina. Go check out all of her work that she's doing. Fabulous woman, carving a path. Go find out more with all the information that I'll put into the show notes. Fabulous having you here. Thank you, Katrina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to the More Confidence with Luna Gaia podcast. I hope you feel more confident, more self-assured, and ready to go tackle the world's problems and maybe kick ass in some of your dreams. If you haven't already, I would love for you to like and subscribe, follow, and maybe leave a review so that other people know how to find this awesome podcast too. If you're wanting to sink your teeth into something even more juicy, my number one best-selling book, Perfectly Imperfect, Your Complete Guide to Loving Yourself and Loving Your Body, is now available on all good bookstore sites, both in print, digital, and I narrated it for Audible as well. If you think that coaching or maybe one of my courses is for you, why not head to www.moreconfidence.com.au and get in touch and see if we can talk. And of course, you can find me all across the social medias. That's Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, which is where you're probably listening now, or maybe even here on the podcast platform. Sending you big love and wishing you a beautiful day.